Aftershocks Trex Titanium.
You know, the titanium is an important part of this product. It makes it strong, light, and durable.
Yes.
You can bend those things around. They don't go out of shape. Fit nicely around your head.
Scott, what you're referring to is the most advanced audio listening device known to man.
Are they? They are for runners, that's for sure, because they keep your ear open to the environment. These things don't go on your ear. They don't go in your ear. They actually rest on the bone right in front of the ear, and it conducts the sound through that bone to your nerve. And that's how you hear the music or podcast.
And what that means to me is safety. If I am out on the road trying to get to the trail, or I'm on the trail, I've got my ears open.
They also are Bluetooth compatible, so you don't have any wires. And you can also fast forward, pause, and you can take calls. If you're taking an afternoon run and you have a conference call, you can do it with the Trex Titanium.
Scott, have you ever been on a conference call on a run?
I'm not going to admit that.
And battery life, surprisingly strong. Have you found that?
Yes.
If you go to trailrunnernation.com and go to our partners page, you can get a great deal.
That deal today is you can get a pair of Trex Titanium bone conductive headphones, and along with that, they will send you a Trail Runner Nation buff.
Scott, that's not the door this time.
It's a flash sale. That's the sound of a flash sale.
Flashlight sale?
Flash sale.
Which means?
What my wife tells me it means is that we're drastically reducing prices just for a short amount of time so you guys can benefit with some good Trail Runner Nation gear for a discount.
It's time to gear up. I mean, miles are increasing. It's time to treat yourself to some cool gear.
It is. So if you go to our store at trailrunnernation.com and as you check out, use the code TRN20. That will give you a 20% discount on everything.
Everything being hoodies, hats, sleeves.
Shirts. We still have some t-shirts. We have the buffs. We have decals and the temporary tattoos, both PEK approved.
So if you're listening to this on a new release, we're talking April 28th through May 6th.
That's correct.
For your 20% discount, that's trailrunnernation.com. Enter the store and then enter
TRN20.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
Yeah. I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
I'm Scott Warren. To the left of me is Zach Bitter, who is joining us as a guest host today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely.
How does it feel to be a guest host?
It feels great. I like.
do you notice the chair has a little more cushion to it?
A little bit, yeah. Well, as I come more often, I feel it's kind of conforming to me. So,
the one thing that is nice being a co-host is a lot of your statements have a question mark at the end of the statement. So you're going to be asking more questions than answering questions, which is fun.
We are really happy to have Chris Kelly on the podcast. And you may have heard him on his own podcast. Zach has listened to it and vouches for it and says it's full of great information. And the name of that podcast, Zach, is
Nourish, Balance, Thrive.
Nourish, balance, thrive. And I like that threesome there.
They're all positive words.
Yes. Chris had reached out to us and said, hey, you know what? Glucose level is an important topic, and it's important for our own nutrition, for our own health. And essentially, I kind of listened to what Chris was saying as a public service announcement. We really owe it to ourselves and others to dig into this glucose thing. It's not just about performing better on race day, but just performing better in life in general. So that's what I'm taking from this so far.
So Chris, welcome to the podcast. Tell us why you are so passionate about this whole glucose level stuff.
Well, I think, first of all, thank you very much for having me. And I'm honored to think that any of you listen to my podcast. That's absolutely amazing. Thank you so much. And to answer your question, it's based on my own personal experience. Right. So I'm a competitive mountain biker, not a trail runner, but I understand what trail running is about. Right. I get out into the woods and I ride trails and I respect that. And You know, I really love the minimalist side of things, and I'm quite jealous of you trail runners that you can just get out there and have fun without having a bunch of equipment to get in the way. But yeah, so I get it. But I'm an endurance athlete. I'm a competitive mountain biker. And a few years ago, I was really serious about upgrading from being a Cat 1 mountain biker to being a pro mountain biker, so to get my UCI pro license. And I did achieve that goal in the end. And I was doing a ton of training, maybe 20 plus hours a week, plus strength training. And I wasn't feeling good at that time. I had a whole bunch of problems that I won't go into now. But the main problem that was very, very concerning to me was that my fasted blood glucose was 120 milligrams per deciliter. Hmm. And I think that most primary care doctors would agree that's, at the very least, pre-diabetes, if not diabetes. And at the time, it was very confusing to me. And since then, I'm a computer programmer, and I've quit my job at a hedge fund. That was about 3 or 4 years ago. I was working at a hedge fund. I quit that job, and I started a functional medicine practice after I figured out all of the things that I needed to figure out in order to restore my fasting blood glucose back to its normal level. And we've now worked with about 1,000 athletes, and many of them had some very similar problems to the ones that I had. And so I really care about blood glucose because I've had to fix it for myself.
Hey Chris, let us know a little bit about, okay, so your blood glucose levels were pretty high, but you're an endurance athlete during this time. What was your diet like? What were you typically eating during this time?
That's a great question. That's a better question than my primary care doctor asked me. No, he's like, oh, well, it's nothing to do with your diet. You're an athlete. You know, there's nothing wrong with you. Even though I had a whole bunch of GI symptoms, right? I had a lot of gas, I had a lot of bloating, I had diarrhea. He sent me to the gastroenterologist for that. And the gastroenterologist was also not interested in what I was eating. And what I was eating was a very high carbohydrate diet, very low fat diet. In fact, I didn't even own any fat. I didn't even own a bottle of olive oil. It was it was all you know, steamed veggies, Teflon, pasta, you know, tomato sauce with sugar in it, maybe a little bit of processed meat, although I was kind of veering towards vegetarianism at that time because I was worried about the saturated fat in meat. So a very high carbohydrate, lots of refined carbohydrates in my diet.
So I'm interested in this this whole evolution. You said you went to your primary care, you went to a gastroenterologist.
It's just a gut doctor is the right way to describe that.
And they weren't concerned about this. So you were you weren't getting any help from the people that should be helping you.
Exactly.
What was the next step then?
Well, the gastroenterologist said to me, you know, we can give you some steroid anti-inflammatory drugs, and that will help with your gut for a while, and then eventually those will stop working, and then you'll have to have surgery. And that didn't sound very good to me, but I was actually on that route. I, you know, I booked the next appointment, and I just happened to have met a woman who had recently finished her master's degree in food science, and she'd reached this juncture where she could either go on to become a flavor chemist or a registered dietitian, and she chose to do neither of those two things because she didn't think she would help anyone. And she said to me, you know, I think you should do an elimination diet before you try either of those two things. And so that's what I did. I tried an AIP paleo elimination diet. So no grains at all. I eliminated wheat completely from my diet. I think that was really important. I eliminated dairy. And my symptoms got much, much better very, very quickly.
In what way? How did that manifest itself?
Well, for the first time, my digestion was somewhat more normal. My fatigue got so much better. My sleep got better. Quantitatively, I was measuring a protein called C-reactive protein, and that's a measure of acute inflammation. And mine was about 7, and it dropped down to 0.5 once I removed those things from my diet. So a huge drop in systemic inflammation once I eliminated those foods.
Do you see a change in that? You said C-reactive protein. Is that what you were measuring?
Yes, exactly.
You cut out just a little bit as you said that. Does that vary with training as well? So if you're out there really hammering and creating some just inflammation from from increased activity. Will that also change with when you're measuring that up?
In theory, yes, it would. And that's what the primary care doctor would write that off as. It's like, oh, yeah, of course, this guy's got a little bit of inflammation. He's riding his bike 20 hours a week. But, you know, now we've run blood tests on 1,000 endurance athletes. That's not what we see. I very, very rarely see a C-reactive protein above 0.5. And if I do see one higher than that, usually the person is like me. They're still eating something that they're really sensitive to. And when they remove that thing from their diet, you know, they have to do a little bit of experimentation, then the C-reactive protein comes right back down into that optimal reference range of 0.5 or less.
So if there's some people out there that are listening, but besides the, you know, the three of us listening to you, and I'm hoping that there will be, do you recommend that you go out and get a baseline blood lab just to see where you're at, as if you're going to make these changes, so that you can start being proactive with something to measure?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's how I got to where I am today, was by taking an interest in my own health, because I got the impression that my doctor didn't really have time to do that. And now I work with several doctors. I know that is the case. One of the doctors I started the business with, she has been working as a primary care doctor for a few years, and she sees 30 patients a day, right? And that's a half day. And so she has 7 minutes for each patient, and she just doesn't have time to do a full proper investigation, even though she would like to do that. And so it's really up to you to take charge of the situation and do your own investigation. And it doesn't need to get complicated. It doesn't even need to get as complicated as measuring C-reactive protein on a standard blood panel. You can just get one of those finger stick tests and measure your fasting blood glucose. And I think that your fasting blood glucose should be between 83 and 88 milligrams per deciliter. And I have some references here, some scientific studies that back up that optimal reference range.
Have you done that, Zach? Have you done your some fasting blood glucose? Have you pricked the finger and analyzed yourself?
Yeah, I've done blood work from time to time, not nearly as in depth as Chris has. I've probably skewed closer to the realm of trying things and just responding to how my body reacts, like similar to what Chris described with like an elimination diet and things like that, just kind of working through trying to understand what works well with my body as opposed to what doesn't. And by kind of going back to square one, so to speak, and like taking out potential allergens or potential trigger foods, I guess you could call them, usually most elimination diets are about a month or 30 days. And then introducing them back one by one, as opposed to trying to guess, oh, well, I think this is what caused it, but maybe it was that or that. That gradual reintroduction can kind of allow you to really see, okay, yeah, that food definitely caused an issue. And for me, some of it was like similar to Chris, is like wheat and certainly commercialized dairy products. I would know the next day if I had any of that, when my body had been kind of cleaned out of it for a while and it was no longer kind of like just assuming that type of response.
I have a question in that this is not a broad brush that we can say everybody needs to eat like this or have a nutrition plan like this. Is that correct? We've talked to Matt Fitzgerald about his book, Diet Cults, and, it's really tough to say this is the way that everybody should eat, or is that what we're saying here? Are there some people that can eat processed carbohydrates and keep their blood glucose at a healthy level and not have the inflammation and not have the sleeping problems and be able to recover properly?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure there is, but my question is, are those people checking? Like, that's what I really want to know is, like, is everybody measuring their fasting blood glucose? It's so easy to do. You can get the meter from Amazon.com for $10. The strips are a few cents each. Hemoglobin A1C is another marker that I think that everybody should be looking at. And that costs $10 from LabCorp or Quest. And, you know, my question is, are these people checking these things or do they just report to be okay?
So you've seen thousands of different athletes come through. What's the most common error or issue that you see that is trending or a pattern with these 1,000 athletes?
Yeah, so you'll see people like me whose fasting blood glucose are drifting further and further away from that optimal range and then more towards the pre-diabetic range. And then you see the same pattern in the hemoglobin A1C. And we look at some more advanced markers that might indicate the same thing, but you can really tell from even those two markers that something's going wrong. And for the people that we work with, they've listened to a lot of health and fitness podcasts, and typically they've tried the elimination diet and they've looked after their sleep, and maybe they've tried some stress reduction techniques because that can be really helpful as well. And they're doing an appropriate training plan and they're still not getting results. And so we do more extensive testing in the same way as a mechanic might hook your car up to one of those expensive machines and get the digital readout to find out what's going on with your engine. That's what we do with urine and blood and stool samples to find out what's going on in the person. But the elimination diet and all the other diet and lifestyle interventions, I think, are the first thing you do, and that's the most important thing.
Did you have a question there, Scott?
Go ahead.
Can we back off just for a second from the benefits to the athlete and just talk about the benefits to the human, whether you're an athlete or not? What are the consequences of us from, you know, the age of 2 to however old you get to live, just to pour down these nonstop of processed carbohydrates, sugars, etc.? What's the longevity issue? What are the consequences of that lifestyle?
Yeah, so, you know, I would argue that all cardiovascular disease, which is the number one killer in US or Western populations, is really just undiagnosed diabetes. That's what my interpretation of the literature is. And so this is not really about your athletic performance, although that is our primary concern at Nourish, Balance, Thrive. This is really, do you want to live a long and healthy life, or do you want to run into some really serious problems, maybe as early as in your 50s?
And then some of those problems being adult onset diabetes?
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm just looking at a paper here, and it talks about the statistics now for type 2 diabetes. And let's see if I can find the thing. So in 2015, 415 million adults globally were suffering from diabetes. And expectations are that the prevalence will rise by almost 55%, up to 642 million cases in 2040. So, you know, this is a serious problem. And I don't think that athletes, you know, in the past, maybe they got a free pass. Oh, well, this diabetes thing, it doesn't affect you because you're burning so much glucose when you're doing your running. But, you know, as we've seen, this is just not the case.
Yeah, and so with diabetes, obviously the issues become not only for vision can be an issue. You can end up with peripheral neuropathy, pain in the feet, and then just not being able to process just sugars at all, or just any of the even the carbohydrates that are okay for us, at least are on the, you know, fructose, things of that nature, become an issue too. So you change your entire lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, you're talking about very, you know, the late stage complications of type 2. But my main concern, and this happens, is that people drop dead of a heart attack without even knowing they ever had an issue. You know, they don't get to the stage where they've got diabetic neuropathy or problems with their vision or even diagnosed with diabetes at all. Their very first symptom is a heart attack that they don't live through.
What is the mechanism of that? What's the pathology that brings on that cardiovascular accident? Or that the heart attack?
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to get into that, actually. You should talk to my... So one of the guys I work with is a medical doctor and also a research scientist. And it's super duper complicated. And I'm not sure that I still understand all of the details. All I know is that if you can get this blood glucose thing under control, then the complications that come down the line are far less likely.
Good. Well, that's reason enough for me.
Talk to us about sugar and the addictive properties of sugar, and then how, when you started this elimination diet, what kind of problems did you encounter by doing that? Any kind of shaky withdrawals or anything?
Yeah, that took me a long time. So I was thoroughly hooked on carbohydrates when I first started these elimination diets. And I'd actually got myself into a bit of a tight spot on the bike where I was. So I know you talked about metabolic flexibility before on the podcast, and I was extremely metabolically inflexible. I could only use carbohydrate in order to fuel my endurance performance. So I was taking one of those maltodextrin gels every 40 minutes whilst I was on the bike. So I'd get back from a 3-hour ride with a back pocket full of those gel wrappers. And it was really pretty ugly. And then I also had 6% carbohydrate solution mixed up in my bottles. And it was a long and painful process. And I used another carbohydrate supplement called Yukan Superstarch, which was extremely helpful as training wheels to get me off the maltodextrin. It was almost like nicotine patches to a smoker. You know? And I think that Yukan have a terrible business model, because once I was better able to be metabolically flexible, which is to say I could tap into both my fat stores and the glucose, then I needed less and less of the Yukan on regular training rides. And in the end, I stopped using it completely. So, you know, when I go for a ride now, I usually have no calories at all in my water. So I don't eat at all on the bike. And I know that Zach is the same. He's not taking on a ton of calories when he goes and does a training ride. So, you know, getting off those refined carbohydrates, I think it was not just important for my diabetes risk, but also important for my exercise performance.
So let's talk both to you, Chris, and to Zach, in terms of time on your wheels or on your feet. When do you say, I'm going out for this amount of time, I better bring some nutrition with me? Let's start with Zach. Zach, what's the length of time that you go out for a training run that you say, I better slide some calories in my pocket?
I would say it's kind of twofold, I guess, in terms of just like bringing things along. If it's anything over a couple hours, I'm going to probably make sure I have water and electrolytes. And then if it's upwards past 4 or 5 hours, then I might bring some carbohydrate along. Sometimes I use it, sometimes I won't. It really, my general kind of rule of thumb is skewed a little more intensity and towards what exactly I'm trying to peak for. So, for example, if I'm trying to get ready for a 100-mile race or not any ultra marathon for that matter, my kind of like rule of thumb or test is if I can wake up in the morning and have very little calories for breakfast, maybe like coffee, some coconut milk and a little bit of raw honey or something like that, and then go out for 4 or 5 hours with nothing but water and electrolytes and not feel like I'm going to bonk at any time, then I know I'm in a fat adapted enough state where on race day I can go out there and I will need very little carbohydrates to kind of sharpen the spear at the end. Or if I need to burn matches going up a hill or putting on a surge or something like that. So that's kind of my test. Less so like, you know, what's my max fat burning rate and all that stuff, and more so like what am I seeing in my own training and my own day-to-day type of stuff.
So Zach, you can go out for 5 hours and not have any additional calories. What about race day? Now we're at, you have a 100-miler coming up. When do you start to trickle in, and that's your term, which I really like, when you start to trickle in that calorie?
Yeah, so what I do for a race is the nutrition plan actually starts or like before the race. So when I wake up in the morning, you know, a lot of people are thinking to themselves, I need to get a bunch of calories in for breakfast or get a bunch of carbs in for breakfast to kind of top off the store, so to speak. But my goal when I start a race is I want to be burning the highest amount of fat as I can. So I don't want to kind of offset that process by eating a bunch of carbs for breakfast or at the starting line and kind of trigger my body into thinking that's its primary fuel source. So I'll usually have a relatively or sometimes very low or no carbohydrate breakfast before the race. And then I'll get out and I'll start going, and I'll usually spend the first 30 to 60 minutes, depending on the intensity of the event, not eating anything, because that's going to really encourage my body to burn fat, especially if my previous meal was a fatty-based meal. And then I'll start trickling it in. And then a lot of that depends on the intensity and duration of the event itself too. But usually from a historical standpoint, I'm somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 to 200 calories per hour. out there when I'm racing. At the end of the day, when I tally it all up, I guess.
May I, Scott?
Yeah.
And all these are coming back to you too, Chris. So
start making your list of answers there, Chris.
Yes, no. So you're out there on the 5-hour training run, and you said there are times that you may withhold the carbohydrate or use it depending on the intensity. What are some indicators that you feel in your body to indicate that, you know what, I need to pour some calories in here? What are some of the items that happen to you?
You know, it's I don't know that there's really any huge red flags for me at this point, because I think I've kind of developed a really, really robust fat metabolizing state. So it's bonking from the nutritional side of things just doesn't really happen. Like, I don't have these nutritional bonks. Mm-hmm. So I've never been in a situation in the last 4 or 5 years where I was like, if I don't get some calories in me now, it's going to be like lying on the side of the trail waiting to kind of revitalize type of a thing. But what I will do is, like, if I'm going to do a long effort that's got any type of intensity in it, that's when I would maybe try to like bring a little bit of carbohydrate along. And even that is rare in training. That's usually reserved mainly for races. On training days and hard workouts, my day-to-day diet flexes a little bit enough where I feel like I have enough carbohydrate on store within my my glycogen stores to really do most of the intensity stuff. So a lot of it in training is it's very rare. I could probably count on one hand how many actual workouts I would do in a year where I would even take in a calorie source. It's mostly just like liquids that have electrolytes with them and stuff like that.
Wow, Scott, I jumped in front of your question. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to add or ask one little tiny question. When you are either training or in a race and you're taking in some calories, are those calories in form of a simple sugar like maltodextrin gel, or are you taking in some coconut milk, some fatty calories also?
Yeah, so for me, the way I kind of look at it is, in terms of fuel sources, you have your glycogen stores, and then you have your own body fat. And you know, people oftentimes misunderstand the way that looks. They think, "Oh, I'm a fit athlete. I don't have any body fat," or like, "I don't have enough body fat." But in reality, what you don't have enough of is the glycogen stores. Even at the leanest state, an athlete at like 5%. Is going to have enough body fat to get them through an ultra marathon. Mm-hmm. So really, in terms of relying on fat for fuel during a race, I try to let my body fat supply that, because that just means one less thing I have to digest, or one less variable I have to deal with on race day. The storages that are finite, if I'm out there like literally all day long, is my glycogen stores. So that's what I would trickle in very slowly. And it's one of those things where I get it from a variety of different sources, and have it from a variety of different experiences, tried different things and stuff like that. I think the key to that is, you know, if you're bombarding your system with too much of that, like when I used to be a high carb athlete, just like Chris, I used to be very much high carb. I was still probably skewed potentially a little further away from processed carbs than maybe he did at first. But what I found is that, I can get away with a little bit of it, and it's kind of like a high octane fuel source. I treat it the same. The way I explain to people is it's like caffeine. You know, if your body is prepared to accept it, it is like rocket fuel, but you don't need a lot of it. You know, there's a margin of diminishing returns where, you know, especially if you're in the heat, you find yourself puking it up, or heaven forbid, coming out the other end. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me personally, what that's meant is, I went from racing and feeling like and potentially needing upwards to 400, maybe even 500 calories per hour of a simple sugar, to being able to reduce that down to 100 to 200 calories per hour, and then eliminate all those big like energy highs and lows throughout the course.
So, Chris, you're out on a training run or training ride for you on your mountain bike. How long do you're planning that section? When do you throw calories in your pack?
I think that I think I've made both mistakes, actually. I've been metabolically inflexible on both ends of the spectrum now. So we already talked about the high carb bit and being trapped into using only glucose. I then went on to eat a ketogenic diet, so very, very, maybe like 30 grams of carbs per day, and got really, really good at burning fat. And I could go, like Zach, indefinitely be completely bonk-proof, which was absolutely unbelievable. Really, really fun. You know, I went through 7-day stage races where I was literally eating nothing during the stage at all, no carbohydrates, and no carbohydrates after the race either, and still feeling really good on day 7. And that worked great. But then when I went to do cyclocross, which is a 60-minute, very intense race, I found that my performance was much, much worse. And it's because you're just, it's a glycolytic sport, right? You need glucose. And so I feel like I'd pushed my metabolism too far in that direction. And what I found was, is that adding back in the carbohydrates a day or two before a cyclocross race is not going to do much. It's not going to change much, right? Your metabolism just doesn't change that fast, in the same way as it didn't change that fast in the beginning when you were trying to become adapted to fat. And so, you know, now the approach that I take is one of metabolic flexibility. So I'm trying to maximize my ability to burn fat, but not do away with my ability to use glucose. Because I think there is a real danger out there for some people, is that they're just going to get rid of their pyruvate dehydrogenase and they're just not going to be able to use sugar anymore, which is itself a problem. So like Zach at the moment, you know, I'm going to go for a 2-hour ride after this interview and I won't eat anything at all. But if it's longer than that, then yeah, I'll add in some more carbohydrates. If it's more intense than that, then I'll add in some more carbohydrates. If it's a race, I'm definitely going to add in some carbohydrates. Not a cycle cross race, 60 minutes, it's not going to make any difference. But you know, if it's a 2.5-hour or 3 or 4-hour mountain bike race, I'm definitely going to be trying to consume some carbohydrates during the race.
You talked about making the transition. How long would someone need to expect to see some changes from this? I want to become more fat adapted and I want to get rid of these refined carbohydrates or being a foiled packet full of goo and relying on that to get me through a race. How long does it take, one would expect? Maybe I'll ask, Zach, we'll start with you. How long did it take you personally to make a transition?
Yeah, you know, you see a variety of experiences, and so it's not necessarily a super clean, like, X amount of days for everyone, because everyone's coming from a different past. And it's very interesting, and I'm sure Chris can talk to this, seeing how many athletes he's worked with, is that, you know, everyone's coming to him at a different level. You know, some people are coming to you that and they're very broken. Some people are coming to you and they're not broken at all, but they're looking just to optimize. So like someone who's like feels good, but maybe just isn't quite functioning at the highest level they potentially can, those folks are probably going to transition relatively quick. Like they switch their macronutrient ratios over to where fat is the primary macronutrient, and they're going to notice very little like transition period, or maybe a couple weeks where they feel a little like they don't have that last gear or that punch that they had when they were eating more carbohydrates. But then again, you could have someone who comes to you where they've been super low fat, like avoiding it at all costs for years, if not a decade plus. You know, they're the ones who are a little more touch and go, because they've just separated themselves from that fuel source for such a long period of time. You can see really, really interesting scenarios where you have to actually bring protein really low as well, because the body is so used to using like glucose or sugar as their fuel source. It would rather convert muscle or rather convert protein into sugar through gluconeogenesis than it would to actually metabolize its own body fat. So it can be a very, very different situation depending on who you're working with and what their past was like.
How about you, Chris? So you can either use yourself to as a reference point for how long it took, or your 1,000 athletes that you observed.
I think I'm by far the worst example I've ever seen, actually. I think it took me 2 years to repair my metabolism. You know, you talk about you've probably seen the Volek and Finney classic books, the Art of Low Carbohydrate Performance. They're talking about this 3 or 4 week period that might be a bit rough for you. For me, it was literally 2 years for me to get over it. And one thing I've noticed is now that I've reintroduced more carbohydrates is that the metabolic flexibility hasn't gone away. I can still do those long, fasted rides. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be completely individual. I mean, you see everything out there on the trails, right? You see those guys that can't go for more than 30 minutes without cramming a Cliff Bar down their neck. And then I've also ridden with guys that they never fell for that marketing on maltodextrin. They just didn't go for it. And they never started eating that stuff. And they still don't eat this stuff. You know, they're in their late 50s even. And they have perfect metabolic flexibility just because they never broke their metabolism in the first place. So I think there's, you know, all types of people out there.
Chris, I'm interested. If it took you 2 years to finally become fat adapted, how did you know you were making progress, or how did you believe that you were on the right track? I mean, after 6 months of doing this, did you see progress, or did you say, you know what, maybe this is not the right thing for me?
It's pretty easy to know whether it's working or not. I'll never forget some of those early mountain bike races where the gun would go off. And, you know, I'd used to be being better than all of the other amateurs. And then I'd be sort of mid packish pro, and the gun would go off and everybody disappears. I mean, everybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my heart rate was up and I felt pretty good. My legs felt good. There was just no power. Like, nothing was happening. It was like I wasn't racing. I was still just doing a training ride. And so gradually, you know, that experience got better and better. And, you know, that's when I knew this was starting to work for me. But like I say, it depends on the event. If you go back to cyclocross, it's very, very short, 60 minutes, then you're going to have to be, you know, fully glycogen replete before you go into an event like that if you want to be competitive at the highest level.
Hey, Chris, I'm going to ask you, and I asked Zach, and I don't even know if there's an answer to it, but
those are the good questions.
Yeah. So as you're out there and you have those carbohydrates at the ready in your pack, what indications do you have with your performance or internally? What's your biomarkers that tell you your clue that, you know what, I need some carbohydrate right now?
I don't feel anything. I'm sure, okay. Zach will be the same. Like, yeah. I wouldn't feel anything. So, you know, what part of the way that I do today is some conversations that I have had with various researchers. So there's one amazing woman in particular, Kieran Clark, who is a biochemistry researcher in the UK. She's at Oxford University, and she spent the last, I don't know how, maybe even two decades developing a ketone ester. And her studies have shown that there's only an advantage of supplementing with this ketone ester if you take it with glucose. And the glucose is needed to regenerate oxaloacetate. So whether you feel it or not, you do need some glucose all of the time, even when you're burning predominantly fat. And so I think there's a performance advantage in racing to still continue to supplement with carbohydrates, even if you feel fantastic without it. I think you're going to perform better with.
Yeah, so what I heard you both say is that you're taking it more as just a supplement, but not because you need it, just to keep the performance at the level that it's at, right?
It's a performance enhancing drug.
Carbohydrate. It's not on the list, though.
You know, along that same, this is something that I remember listening to. Maybe it was on Brad Kern's podcast that he does, that you need to have some glucose in your system so that you can metabolically use the fat stores. Is that true?
That's exactly, you've just rephrased exactly what I just said, and it's okay. It's easy to understand with what you just said.
Evidently, I wasn't listening.
Scott's famous for that.
No, I promised to explain it like I was five, and I immediately broke my promise. I apologize for that.
So it's actually in a good thing. Like Zach says, I'm trickling in the carbohydrates. You're doing that not just for the rocket fuel, but you're also doing that to keep the metabolism of the fat going.
Stoking the fire, yeah.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, it's really intriguing to me because it really does seem like nowadays with the amount of information available to us, I think that can be a positive. We've got all these resources at our disposal and they're easily accessed. But you know, as humans, we tend to still want to kind of like put ourselves into a camp. So it's like you'll get like groups where they're just anti-carbohydrate. They want to demonize carbohydrate. And then you have the opposite end of the spectrum where they're high carbohydrate and they're like, you know, carb up, do this, do that. And it's like, well, here we have two polar ends. It's like, does it have to be an all or nothing game? And for me, I feel like the answer is no. It's something where like, let's look at these things as tools and use these tools when they're most appropriate. So for me, like, in the early stages of my training and my base building and stuff, or during recovery, I dropped my carbs incredibly low, like a Jeff Volek ketogenic or like Atkins style low carbohydrate, like Chris referred to when he first got going. And I feel like that kind of like lays the base or the foundation to be very, very fat adapted. And then as my training progresses into some more intensity stuff, a little higher volume, some more strength work, just more overall hours working out per week is when I'll start kind of trickling in some of those carbohydrates again, which is twofold. I think it's keeping me metabolically flexible, like Chris talked about, as well as allowing me to kind of like hit the gas when I need to hit the gas in a hard workout or a race. You know, it's very similar to a periodized training cycle where like the way I look at it is, you know, I don't go out and do the exact same workout every day. So why would my diet be exactly the same every day? And kind of periodizing your nutrition to match your lifestyle, I think is very important. And you know, that's an individual journey for everybody to determine kind of, you know, what path works best for them. And it also kind of requires a pretty open mind and being able to admit you're wrong when you're wrong and stuff like that too, in order to really find what's going to work for you at the end of the day.
And I just want to reiterate, this is kind of a pendulum, right? You know, I just recently did a metabolic efficiency test, which the doctor reminded me that I should probably be a quilter instead of a runner. but at any given type, in any given time, you're burning both carbohydrates and fats. It's just the ratio between the two. Yeah. So even if you are super, you know, fat adapted like Chris and like Zach, at any given heart rate, they are burning some percentage of carbohydrates. I don't think it's impossible. I think it's impossible to just burn fat 100%, right?
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. And then if you're not eating the glucose, you have to ask, where is it coming from? Is it coming from my bicep? Where's it coming from?
Right. And I think there's more information coming out now about the body's ability to convert proteins and fats into glucose. And I think one of the big questions is like, well, how fast and how efficient can you make that happen? One thing we do know is glucose levels are being restored to some degree, regardless of the number of carbohydrates that you're eating in your daily diet. It's actually a pretty rare scenario in which your glycogen stores are completely depleted. You almost have to try to go out of your way to do that. Because when you think of it, like just to survive, you're not really going to be doing a whole lot of like, you know, 5K to marathon efforts. That's just not a very like routine movement, I guess, in terms of the pace and distance. You know, there's probably a lot more like very slow movements and then like a couple like fast ones depending on what you're trying to do. So like from like the way our bodies are designed, it's like, you know, that bonk, so to speak, is very unfamiliar type of terrain for humans.
So Chris, you know, when we first started this podcast, how many years ago, Don? A long time ago. We had a nutritionist, Sunny Blende, who we absolutely love. She's freaking awesome. And her nutrition philosophy has changed over the years. But the one point that she was making is we have a finite level of glycogen stores in our bodies. And the original thought is after a workout, we need to take in 300 to 400 calories of carbohydrate to restore those glycogen stores. So what do we do now? If we're trying to become fat adapted and we're trying to teach our body to burn more fats, do we forget about that? Or is there still some truth behind, you still got to top off that little minor tank over there, the secondary tank of glycogen stores?
The post-workout carbohydrate push.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've certainly not felt the need to do that, nor have any of my clients felt the need to do that.
Okay.
I don't think it's especially important. I'm not sure it's particularly easy to monitor either. Like, how would you know how depleted your glycogen stores were and how many grams of carbohydrate you would need to replete them? I think that all you can do is just take a rough guess and stick to eating real food, and you'll get a good result.
Well, and Zach, did you say that some of the studies that you've read is those glycogen stores get replenished without eating a carbohydrate snack, if you will, at the end of a run?
Yeah, if you give yourself enough time between efforts, you can restore your glycogen stores without eating carbohydrates. The FASTER study, I believe, indicated actually very similar rates of glycogen replenishment. Now, that being said, the FASTER study was a workout exposure that was 65% VO2 max. So the question would still remain, like, well, how does that differ with a higher intensity effort? Which I think are cool questions to be asked and probably more so explored as we go further down this journey of nutrition and performance. But the other thing I think of for myself and what I've noticed in my training is more often than not, I drop the carbs really low after a hard effort because then I'm in recovery mode. Like any big workout is pointless if it isn't met with ideal recovery. The recovery is when the real growth and the real progress towards getting stronger and better occurs. So unless I'm heading right back out to do another workout very soon after, I'll actually drop the carbs really low after that intensity, let the inflammation flush out, let the recovery process begin and stuff like that. If I have enough time till my next workout, I'm not concerned about relying on carbohydrates to restore my glycogen levels. What I may do in a scenario like that would be after the workout, go low carb for that next meal afterwards. And then if I do have a back-to-back big workout type of scenario, that night at dinner, I'll have a few more carbohydrates with a fatty meal to kind of give myself a few extra high octane energy, food items for that following morning's workout or big effort.
And in fairness, the opinion expressed by Scott and labeled to Sunny Blend may not be her position now.
No, I'm telling you, it's not. Yeah. She was the first one that brought this whole transition up, if you recall back.
I just wanted to
get
her defense.
Another thing to mention with that too is, if I was working with an athlete who told me, like, I'm going to do the high carb thing, I'm not doing the high fat thing, I would very much have them replace a post-workout effort with carbohydrates if that was their mode of energy source. I don't have athletes that come to me with that.
It's because you kick them to the curb, don't you?
Well, it's
why are you coming to me?
they're probably going to find a different coach if that's what their agenda is, I guess. So. Yeah. And there's a lot of coaches out there, so finding that match I think works for everyone's best interest. But yeah, it's one of those things where if you're working with someone who's very, very carb dependent and you look at what's happening to their body, it's like when they run out of carbs, yeah, they need more carbs. The long-term kind of way to go about that would be to introduce some fats so that person can be less carb dependent and then not need as much afterwards, like what you'd see. But it's just, the variety of people that you could potentially have coming to you.
So Chris and Zach, you've both been up front with the front runners and front riders. What percentage are fat adapted, really concentrating on that? And are there still some carbohydrate dependent athletes that are performing at the very highest level? Chris, do you want to take a stab at that and Zach follow up with the trail?
Shit, that's a really good question. I have a feeling that some of the most gifted athletes, one of the things that makes them so gifted is they are naturally good fat burners. Mm. So on the bike, they're just not needing a ton of carbohydrates because they're so good at accessing their stored body fat. But certainly in the highest level at mountain biking, I'm still seeing carbohydrate being consumed a lot during the races, certainly more than I would consume. In cyclocross, less so. Like, people just don't eat. It's like too short. It's not even entering into the equation. But yeah, I'm doing very different races from Zach, obviously. And I'm also competing at a very different level. Like, Zach is obviously a world-class athlete, whereas I'm a hobby pro, right? I'm doing this for fun and no other reason. Nobody's giving me any money to race anything. So very different.
Well, you went from category one to a pro racer. That's not everybody's.
The license, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's one thing to get the license and it's one thing to be any good, at least when you're with respect to Zach. So it's different.
You're very humble. So Zach,
are there any licenses for trail running?
just our driver's license.
Just the driver's license to get to the trailhead. Okay, just checking, because I don't have one, and I may be breaking the law because I don't have a license.
How about you, Zach? What percentage of the athletes that are up front are fat adapted and really focus on that as their primary fuel source?
I would agree with Chris where I feel like it's still very much the minority. I think more people are exploring it. And I think it's kind of hard to tell with elites as well because, I'm very open on my blog and website and stuff about what I'm doing. And there are other athletes that are like that as well. But especially like in the triathlon community, a lot of those folks are trying to kind of keep that a secret. They don't want people to know their recipe, right, their secret to success, so to speak. So they're not as open about sharing that stuff. So they're kind of do things, figure out what works for them, and then they're going to kind of keep it hidden. So it's one of those metrics. It's really hard to put a finger on. But with that said, I still would be shocked if there was any data showing that, a high fat approach is something that the majority or even, a good chunk of the elites are doing at the moment.
Yeah, I think maybe the triathlete will put on a carbohydrate jersey, even though they're fat adapted.
I love carbs. Maybe we should sell those on our website. I love carbs.
Hey, do you have a sense of other endurance sports and communities that are out in front with this? Is it trail running and mountain biking that have kind of caught the vision, or are we way behind? Or are kayakers out there that do endurance stuff? Is there another group or population that's big on this?
I see stories about cyclists, especially the longer stage cyclists, triathletes and things like that. Whether how true they are or not is up to the reader's discretion, I suppose. But yeah, there's definitely most, I would say, endurance sports have kind of at least dipped their toe into the world or have examples they can point to as to like, oh, this is our athlete who does that approach.
Yeah, fast packing. Mm-hmm. Another one. Chris, any thoughts on that of other communities that are hot on this?
Yeah, I mean, so the longer the event that you compete in or train in, the more relevant it's going to become. So I've interviewed a bunch of experts from road cycling, and they're all talking about this. So in particular, Barry Murray is an Irish sports nutritionist, and he's been working with Team BMC and some others. And they're definitely doing this, right? They're doing the fasted state training first thing in the morning. They're cycling their carbs, as Zach described. They're doing all of it. And of course, James Morton from Team Sky has got some interesting lectures online. So he's been talking about fasted state training for a long time. So those guys, I think, are definitely doing it. But, shorter activities like the CrossFit guys or obstacle course racers, like, this doesn't work for them at all. So it's really going to be specific to each individual sport.
What's your first meal of the day? How long do you wait before you start putting in some calories? And this is outside, Zach, of your coffee and a little bit of raw honey, that type of thing. When does your first official meal, Chris? So we'll start with you on that, if you don't mind. And we don't mean to invite a guest on, Chris, and then bring a co-host on it. And you guys are, but you're both great resources. It's been really fascinating to talk about the trail side and then the mountain biking side and watch the intersection. So it's been a fun discussion for me, at least so far. When's your first meal, Chris?
As soon as I get up. I might be a bit different from what you might expect. People say, oh, you're fat adapted and you don't get hungry anymore and you can eat as, whenever you want. And that is true. I could eat whenever I want. And that's in stark contrast to how I was before, when I had to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to eat a big bowl of cereal just to see me through the night. I'm very different from that. But I still eat as soon as I get up, because I think that eating is an important cue that entrains circadian rhythm. So in order to have a really nice, solid photo period and really good sleep, I found that eating first thing is really important. And then I'm done eating by about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I have still quite a long overnight fast, but I shift most of my calories forward into the day. So I'm eating them mostly in the morning and then not so much at night. And so I'll just eat whatever there is. Like, I don't eat specific foods for breakfast. So this morning, my wife weighed a really nice sort of lamb stew thing in an Instapot, like a pressure cooker. And we had parsnips that were roasted. So there were some carbs, but they were whole food carbs, with the fiber and the water and everything else. And that was the same thing I had for dinner the night before. So I don't have special meals for special times of the day.
So it might not be just what time of the day that you eat, but really how long you go without eating. It would have been the better question.
Still, yeah, exactly. So there's still a 14-hour overnight fast, but I'm still eating at 6 o'clock in the morning, right? I'm just done eating really early too.
Okay, so Zach, you can answer that either way. When's your first meal, or how long do you go without, you know, eating anything at all?
Yeah, it probably will look completely different depending on what day you pick of the week. I'm very much intuitive with that at this point. Like I kind of feel like I've gone through those steps of, like, I guess microanalyzing this type of stuff, where now it kind of just happens naturally, or my body knows to tell me what, when, and where. But that the circadian rhythm thing that Chris mentioned is very interesting stuff. And if you're interested about that, you should give Bill Lagakos, Dr. Bill Lagakos, a follow on Twitter, because he's been doing some deep dives into like how like meal timing affects your sleep quality. And from my own personal like kind of experiences, what I found is if I try to backload my calories, so to speak, because it can be very easy to do if you're fat adapted, because you just don't have those real sharp hunger pangs that kind of force you to the dinner table. And what I found is when I kind of like stave off meals just for whatever reason, getting busy or something like that, and end up eating the majority of my calories in the latter half of the day, I just don't sleep as well. When I do eat during daylight time, I find that I sleep a lot sounder at night. When I'm in heavy training, I sleep more, as opposed to just kind of keeping that same sleep schedule regardless of how hard I go. So for me personally, I find that very valuable to kind of keep it within the ranges of the sun, so to speak. So some mornings I'll wake up and I'm not going to do my hard workout for a few hours, and I'll definitely eat something just because I don't want to end up having 2 or 3 o'clock come around and having done a big workout and eaten very little that day so far, because then I'm playing catch up with a couple hours left in the day. But if I wake up and I'm going to do just a long, easier run or something like that first thing in the morning, maybe even before the sun comes up, then I'll usually just have the coffee and, you know, a little bit of cream maybe, and then go out and then have my first meal when I get back.
Do you guys either dabble with periodic fasting? I mean, more than the 14 hours, like a 24 or 48 hour fast in your training?
Not a ton, because I kind of have a unique lifestyle, I feel. Like for me, it's like if I would, let's say, do a 12 or 14 hour fast before I wake up and then do a 20 mile run in the morning, if you look at the caloric expenditure that I would take on during that, you know, 16 hour window, it would mimic the caloric expenditure of like someone who is going to fast for like 24, 36 hours. And I think there is some value in fasting that long, but not necessarily in the midst of training for a race or something like that. So when I do have any type of like structured, I guess I'm going to kind of, it wouldn't be structured in this scenario, but like if I am going to do a fast that's longer than that, it's going to be during like my off season, my downtime, and it's going to somewhat happen intuitively as well. It's not going to be like, oh, well, I feel like I need to lose weight or I need to do a fast or something like that, so I'm not going to eat for 24 hours. It would be more of a, you know, like let's get the inflammation flushed out, reset the whole high fat metabolism process when I'm doing very little workouts. So, you know, that's kind of how that plays. That's how that tool would be used, I guess, in my schedule.
How about you, Chris?
Yeah, you have to be careful with these things. I have done some experimentation. So there's a researcher called Volta Longo that's done some really interesting research. If you Google that name, you'll find some really good presentations. There's one with Rhonda Patrick that was very good. And my wife constructed his fasting mimicking diet. So this is a low calorie diet that mimics fasting, and you get some of the benefits of fasting with just some calories. And I did that for 5 days and I was totally miserable. It was horrible. I really hate it. And I think that Zach does have a good point that the exercise could be fasting in fast forward, right? You're creating the same calorie deficit, but in less time with exercise. But it's important to point out that there may be some inflammatory burden that goes along with the exercise that you wouldn't get with the caloric restriction. And the other thing I would really want to say about this is it's been very popular and trendy, and I've heard it on lots of different podcasts, the fasting thing. But for athletes that are really charging hard, if you layer these things on top of each other, it ends in disaster almost, right? So you hear somebody talk about protein restriction, and then someone talking about carbohydrate restriction, and then somebody talking about fasting, and you're like, oh, I need to do all of these things.
Yep.
And then suddenly you have this huge hormonal crash, and then you come to my doorstep and start doing some tests trying to figure out what went wrong. But I can tell you what's going to go wrong right now. Don't do all of those things at once. It always goes wrong.
Yeah, just to add to what Chris just said too, when we're looking at stress, you have to look at it holistically. Stress right. comes from so many different angles, and in fasting, if you're not ready for it or if you're putting it in the wrong spot, that's going to be a huge stress to your hormones and to your body. So if you're pairing that up with stress from training, stress from life, stress from friends and family and stuff like that, work, whatever, and then that stress piles up too high, it's always going to be negative. So like to kind of go back to the original question, like the best spot for a fast would be in the probably the lowest stress point in your year or month or however you're often you're looking to employ it.
Well, let's talk about stress hormones for just a minute. How does this diet or this nutritional philosophy work with cortisol levels and stress?
Yeah, so I mean, we've tested the urinary hormones and looked at metabolites of cortisol in hundreds and hundreds of athletes, and there's no deleterious effects. Like sometimes people say that the diet is stressful, and I think what they're referring to is that initial period of change can be quite stressful, mm-hmm. and maybe you'd see an increase in cortisol then. But in the testing that we've done, we don't see any difference between people eating a high carb diet we don't see people eating a high carb diet for the most part, but between people eating a mixed diet and a very high fat diet. So I don't think, you know, I don't think there's really any argument there with cortisol.
So here's my question. Somebody's out there listening to this and they're trying to decide, you know, I think I'm going to do it. Chris, what did you notice in your performance or when you looked in the mirror? I don't care what vantage point you're going to choose here for trying to sell us and bring us over into your camp. What did you notice that changed when you made this adaptation?
Such a great question. This is the most important question, and I'm so glad you asked it. So for me, you know, I said that I was a hobby pro and I just did racing for fun. Well, for me, it's been able to get back from a long training ride. I can ride with my buddies for 3 and 4 hours on a Saturday and then come back and still be a functional human being. It's fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
I have a 3.5-year-old girl now, and I can still play with her. I can do stuff after I ride. And before, I couldn't do that. If I was to do a 3-hour ride, I'd be on the couch for the rest of the day eating carbohydrates.
I remember those
with
days.
Brain fog. Yeah. And then at night, I wouldn't sleep. You know, so that's really why I'm doing this. That was the main advantage. And that was why I pushed it harder and harder and harder and continued with the same thing for so long was... It was just so amazing to feel amazing after you've trained. But, you know, now I realize that perhaps I didn't need to go quite that far in order to get those results. And you can eat a mixed diet and still achieve those same things.
Is your 3.5-year-old fat adapted?
Yeah, she is. She is totally fat adapted. She's never been exposed to anything. She's like I keep her in a little bubble. You know? She's never seen gluten. She's never drunk cow's milk. She's still being breastfed, even though she's 3.5. She's like the perfect, you know, at some point my world is going to come crashing down so hard, I know. But yeah, she never demands food. She can go as long as you want or as short as you want. She's absolutely amazing. And I just wish that I had had that same upbringing, and then maybe I wouldn't be in the position that I am now. Although it has been fun to start a business and find my passion.
Well, Chris, brace yourself when you come home and she's in the corner over there with a bottle of Coca-Cola or something. Just
Yeah, I know. And that's what I worry about. It's like if you deny them when they're young, they're just going to want it even more. And it's completely normal. You know, Rob Wolf's book, Wired to Eat, explains why everybody craves sugar, right? That's just a normal evolutionary advantage for every human being. And so, of course, if you give her a sugary, gluten-free cupcake, she just inhales it in less than 5 seconds. But yeah, I'm never going to get away from that. No one is.
Hey, Zach, same question to you. What did you notice as a change in either performance or the way you feel as you made your change?
Yeah, mine was fairly similar with Chris, where like it seemed like it was the things I noticed or that were the most, I guess, beneficial to me as just, you know, a person was the stuff I saw outside of the training. Like I went from waking up multiple times at night to go to the bathroom or just because I was wide awake to sleeping through the night much deeper. I went from having like energy swings throughout the day. At the time when I made my transition, I was a full-time school teacher, and when I was high carb, I could have taken a nap at 2 o'clock every afternoon if I had wanted to. Whereas when I switched the diet, it was within a month I noticed that, you know, I basically from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to bed, I had a steady stream of energy. throughout the day, no peaks and valleys, so to speak. And the third thing that I noticed quite a bit too was just the amount of inflammation or water retention in my legs, ankles, and even in the abdominal region, that would occur after really hard training stimuluses. That stuff kind of started to go away, or if it did occur, it flushed out really, really fast.
So Zach, you were a school teacher. I didn't know that. I'm going to ask both Chris and Scott, and I'll weigh in too. What do you think he taught? What grade do you think he taught? And Zach, hold off on the answer. And we'll start with you, Chris. What do you think Zach Bitter would teach?
Oh my God, that's such a difficult question.
Yeah.
I honestly have no idea. I'm completely useless. I come from the UK where we don't have the age grade. So I don't even know. Like you said to me, fifth grade, I don't know how old that is. So I'm such a useless person to ask that question.
So fifth grade, he says. All right.
Scott?
I think it was high school. High school.
Yeah.
English.
I'm not going to say.
What are you going to say?
I'm not going to say a PE teacher, but I think you're very interested in sciences. I think math. I think you were a math teacher in middle school.
Okay. Most people guess math and science, and The true answer is actually everything, because I started out subbing and everything from kindergarten through 12th grade. I eventually ended up in middle school teaching special ed for a couple of years, and then ultimately my last 2 years of teaching, I was at a high school we had a charter license as well as being part of the public school district, so we had a lot of flexibility in what we taught. So we designed all our courses based on topics. So then we would teach everything from English to math to science to social studies. And
so I was right.
So we're all right.
Yeah, you can't be wrong when you guess my teaching background.
I thought detention. I thought you were really going to focus on that.
Hey, there were two items, food items, that came up in this podcast that I still am confused about. And I want to just, as we're wrapping this thing up, Zach, you mentioned, I wrote it down here, raw honey. First of all, I don't know what the difference is between raw honey and non-raw honey. Isn't all honey the same thing?
Basically, what it comes down to is we alluded to this at the beginning, is just the processing of foods. And I think at the end of the day, whether you're dealing with carbohydrates, fats, or proteins, trying to get the whole foods non-processed as the majority of your intake is a huge first step. So raw honey would be the closest. Raw, unheated honey would be the closest thing to the actual honey itself without all the processing that would occur potentially in, a lower grade.
And does that not count as a carbohydrate?
Oh, it very much does. It's still all carbohydrate based. I mean, the biggest difference, I guess, between a honey source and maybe table sugar is the speed at which your body would potentially respond to it. It's lower on what they would call the glycemic index as pure table sugar or white bread or something like that. But I view it very much as a high octane, pure carbohydrate fuel. So when I use it very sparingly and in the right moment, in my opinion.
Okay.
So a white bread sugar sandwich is definitely out, right?
Yeah. Chris, you actually, I think both of you mentioned this at one point, milk from a cow. Is that bad? And why is it bad?
Because we're not cows?
Because it's not a carbohydrate, right?
I just wouldn't touch dairy in the US. If you can put your face on the cow's udder, then sure, go ahead. But if you're buying the stuff that you get in your local gas station, I'm not sure that's the same food product, even though they're both called milk. My wife actually studied dairy allergies in the lab. That was her thing. And she just saw so many problems with dairy allergies that she just chooses to avoid it completely. I mean, she has personal problems with skin issues when she consumes dairy. And we assumed that, if she was, that our daughter would be the same. And so she's just never had it. It's a super common food allergy for little kids. They get weaned onto cow's milk and they start developing asthma or allergies or some other kind of problem. So we've never had it. But just having said that, we've never done that thing where, if you can put your face on the cow's udder and get it super fresh, does that make a difference? I'm sure it makes a difference.
Yeah.
They're hard to get in your refrigerator, though.
Well, I have to say, I kind of grew up on a dairy farm, and raw milk is where it's at.
It's different, mm-hmm. huh?
It is so much better.
Do you drink it warm, Scott?
No, heavens no. I like to put it in the refrigerator. My uncle taught me this. You put it in the refrigerator, really, really cold, so it almost crystallizes.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss that.
And it's whole then, too. So it tastes way better.
Oh, yeah. That's great stuff.
Chris Kelly, it was our pleasure to have you on this podcast. And we want to direct people to your podcast, Nourish, Balance, and Thrive. And I'm definitely going to subscribe to that because you've got a lot of good things to say. And I know there's more on those episodes that you've created. So I look forward to doing that.
And if someone's interested in getting in and finding more out about themselves, how do they get in touch with you?
Sure, you can come to my website, nourishbalancethrive.com, and there's a button you can press on the front page of the website, and you can book a consultation. That my wife, who I mentioned several times in this interview, you can actually talk to her about your diet and lifestyle, and she can tell you about how some of the testing that we do can improve your athletic performance and longevity. And thank you so much. It's been an absolute privilege. I had no idea what I was getting into here, but this has been really fun.
And Zach Bitter, you'll see him on the trails if you don't blink. And he also is a coach that you can find more information out at zachbitter.com, right?
Yep.
Running for Team Ultra and racing Western States this year. So looking forward to watching you out there in your fat adapted state racing through those canyons.
I'm gonna be on the side of the trail with like these big pouches of Kool-Aid, sugared Kool-Aid, tempting Zach as he travels past.
And white bread sugar sandwiches. Hey, thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
Go out and run.
Sugarless.
Moss.